This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor with Professor H.J. Mackinder. Each week we examine the point of view of three capitals engaged in the conflict in Ukraine, Moscow, Kiev, and now Brussels. Brussels is simultaneously the capital of the European Union, the European Project, and NATO. NATO now has two new applicants, Finland and Sweden. About Finland, there is a treaty since 1948 between Finland and Russia. Finland derives some of its energy supplies from Russia, not as much as you would imagine, because Finland depends upon nuclear power and hydroelectric power for the bulk of its energy needs. But it's a very long border. Finland is a small population. It does use Petersburg as a port of entry for its shipping, and Russia can delimit that. Also, Finland has to be vulnerable to Murmansk Oblast. Murmansk reinforced would threaten all of Finland. Nevertheless, the Finnish people have decided to take the risk and join NATO after decades of sitting out the first Cold War, which was actively hostile most of the time. Sweden, on the other hand, is more of a buffer back from Russia, but it does mean that the Baltic Sea is now effectively militarized, and the way NATO works, it's a NATO lake. Professor, Brussels' point of view, is Sweden joining and Finland joining, is that a win?
Oh, it is a massive win, because it transforms NATO from being essentially a single horizontal line from the Russian border to England, with the United States way off beyond the seas, to being in effect a triangle, which has another leg that goes up 1,000 miles along the Finnish and then the Swedish borders. And Sweden, the fact that both Finland and Sweden, which have been painstakingly neutral and very careful not to antagonize Russia, the fact that they have now made decisions to join NATO and to contribute to NATO with broad public support tells us that not the United States, but rather their observation of Russia has convinced them that the neutral position is no longer sustainable. I remember that the greatest Finn who ever lived, Marshal Mannerheim, who saved Finland in the Winter War of 1939, spent the beginning of his whole career in the army of the Tsar, and he didn't begin to learn to speak Finnish until he was 50. Finland had become a Grand Duchy of Russia in 1808, and she was gradually incorporated into Russia. Then she became somewhat independent, but she was meticulous in maintaining neutrality in the Cold War, although she was well armed. Sweden is, to me, an even more remarkable case, because they've effectively not done wars since 1812. And during a recent trip to Sweden, I talked to somebody who knew something, and I said, he was joking with me, and I said, well, what about Russia? And his face completely changed. We are now having a national conversation about this, and the Swedes have now, in effect, made themselves, if not the masters of the Baltic Sea, a power that is able to deny mastery of the Baltic Sea to anybody else. You mentioned St. Petersburg in Finland. Recall that to get to St. Petersburg, one has to sail between Estonia and Finland for 250 miles along the Gulf of Finland. So although it may be that the Russians can cut off trade from Finland, Finland does have a coast on the Baltic Sea, which Russia does not have. And if Finland and Estonia decided to close St. Petersburg, they could do this very easily. So this is a huge, this transforms the whole strategic environment that Russia finds herself in. And this is one of the things that I encourage them to think about. It brings me then to the question of how do the other European powers feel about all this? Because there's no question that Finland and Sweden have made these decisions out of very serious consideration of their own security. The support, and I think the Germans have done the same. They are so close to the fire, and they have noticed that the Americans have not come to put it out. And they've figured it out, and they have decided they're going to make themselves a strong power. But if you go further west, you find that Mr. Macron wants to see a peace that is not a clean victory, but it's a sort of a negotiated settlement in which perhaps Russia gets to keep some bits of Ukraine and so forth, which, it must be noted, would be a complete violation of international law, the rule of the United Nations, and any number of treaties that have been signed. So this would be a non-trivial step. Mr. Scholz apparently has also privately taken up issues with Mr. Putin about, well, what would it really take to solve this thing? And Mr. Draghi from Italy is sort of on the same boat, although I would say the Brits most definitely are not. So there is a kind of a wet faction within NATO that is hoping against hope for a negotiated peace, which I think we can say will settle nothing and lead to more war. If I may simply quote the Prime Minister, Kaja Kallas of Estonia, in an interview with an American newspaper, she said, "Peace cannot be the ultimate goal. I only see a solution as a military victory that could end this once and for all, and also punish the aggressor for what he has done. Otherwise," she said, "we go back to where we started. You will have a pause of 1 year, 2 years, and then everything will continue." And I think that this Prime Minister of Estonia has it right. We have really to nobble Russia and make it impossible for her to aggress. And that can only be done if it is clear to Russia that she has been defeated. If she walks away with some sort of consolation prize and something around which she can spin a fantasy of victory, then the purpose of the war has not been accomplished.
Unconditional surrender, Professor?
Well, it's interesting. Unconditional surrender is not really a sound military concept at all. As Clausewitz said, war is politics with an admixture of violence. The reason that unconditional surrender was adopted in World War II was it was the only war goal that France, England, the United States, and the Soviet Union could agree on. As soon as we went into detail about what we were going to do after we won, we got in disagreement. So we said, well, let's just have them surrender unconditionally. I think it'd be most unwise to force Russia. We couldn't. Ukraine's not going to force Russia to surrender unconditionally. In fact, Ukraine says she wants negotiations, but she wants real negotiations that are clean. She doesn't want a replay of the Minsk Accords that were really a child and part of the Obama administration and contained so many ambiguities and so little support that they simply kept the war going on. What we must do, but ideally, with U.S. leadership, and there is a big question mark, we have to envision a new post-war world. with a security system that encompasses the world island, Eurasia, that loops all the way around to Japan and Korea and so forth. And this system must deter Russia, but it should also be tolerable to Russia. It must not be a thorn in the side of Russia the way the Treaty of Versailles was to Germany. We have to somehow bring the Russians back in, but we just don't give them the keys to all the doors and the run of the house. In other words, we need a stable and enduring peace. We've got to start designing that now. I think we should have working groups composed of representatives from all of the countries, ideally with Ukrainians and Russians on them, talking about how we get out. I think this is imperative. But what indication do we have that this is going on? I see no sign whatsoever that our American administration has the vision. We can't see beyond worrying about whether a multi-rocket launch system might be more dangerous than a howitzer. That's something for the military guys to think about. Our diplomats should be trying to envision a peacekeeping system that does not have the defects of the League of Nations and the United Nations. In other words, one that is not based on fantasy, but on fact, but that also includes all the players and keeps them all stably at peace with one another. If I could just conclude by saying it's very disappointing. I don't see any indication of this process. For this process to succeed, Europe, Russia, Ukraine, the United States, all of these players are going to have to talk. And the big question we have, in World War II, we essentially knew who the victorious big three would be, although Attlee replaced Churchill at a certain point, and Truman replaced Roosevelt at a certain point. But we had developed, in the course of dozens of meetings, some idea of where we were going. But if you ask today, what will the Russia be that is going to be involved in the peacekeeping process, we really have no idea. We don't know whether Putin will be alive or will he'll be in authority. Which Europe will it be? Again, the Europeans are ambivalent enough and vague enough that it's not clear that we have a consensus with them. And most important, which United States? Are we going to have coming from off from stage right or something mysteriously, Elihu Root or I believe that Pompeo was one of our greatest secretaries of state, or J.Q. Adams, who was certainly our greatest? Or are we going to have, William Jennings Bryan? It's very, very hard to know. So we have a degree of uncertainty, not just about the structure of the peace, but actually about who the people are who are going to make it. And I think that now Ukraine is approaching a certain kind of military resolution. And I think they will have the sense to take everything back and then say, okay, that's all we want. But the only person whom I would be willing to bet was going to be present at the peace talk is in fact Zelensky. And even that's not for certain, but I think that he has shown a degree of persistence in the job of president of Ukraine that very few people expected. And I think that he will dominate the peace talks just as he has dominated the war, because if he says no, then he and Poland and Slovakia and Czechia and Romania and Sweden and Finland, the countries that are really threatened, they can go on fighting without even the rest of NATO, although I don't think that NATO would disengage, or even the United States would disengage. We're getting deeply involved, but we still, in America, we have no idea of what our real war aims are, and this is very bad.
Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.